Here tonight, the topic of the shiur of Baruch Yehoshua Yerachmiel Rabinowitz. Now, this series over the last couple of years, talking about profiles of persecution, this is a little bit different. He survived the war. He actually survived physically intact. He wasn't even in a concentration camp or a death camp or anything. He was able to get out. But as you see the story, see the different impacts that the Holocaust had that we don't necessarily think about. This is somewhat of a personal connection as well. I guess my grandfather, my father's father, was a Munkach Chassid. He grew up in a small town near Munkach, closer to Chust, and his family actually moved to Chust when he got a little bit older, because Chust had the big yeshiva in town to learn by the Aruga Saposem, was Rav Yehoshua Greenwald. Rav Moshe Greenwald. He had a son, Rav Yehoshua Greenwald, my grandfather learned in the yeshiva for a short amount of time until the war started, and then my grandfather ultimately was in Auschwitz and then came out. My grandfather's uncle, my grandfather's father was a businessman. My grandfather's uncle was someone named Rav Chaim Yisachar Dov Gross, who we actually have a sefer from him. I talked to my father last night. He's not sure how we got the sefer. I'm not sure who. This was reprinted after the war. This is not. You can see it's a new cover and everything. It's a sefer on Chumash. He was a dayan and taught in Petrova, as well as a rebbe in the city of Munkach itself. It's called the Sefer Ksivas L'Chaim. This is a Sefer on Chumash. It says it's reprinted by somebody who apparently has become his life work to go and find these types of star from before the war and reprint them and put them together, etc. So that's all the Haskamos here in the beginning. We thank you so much, Rabbi Rotner, for doing all this important work. It seems to me that he's either a Satmar Chassid, probably a Satmar Chassid, that does this. Munkach and Satmar are neighbors, and they're connected and a little bit intermingled as well in terms of their hashkafos, and Munkach is in that world, perhaps not as the fact that they're maybe not known for having those types of shitos now is because Satmar became much more powerful after the war, and the personality is right, especially in the immediate aftermath of the war, and the personalities are a little bit different, as we'll see. But that's the hashkafa we're talking about. That's the world we're talking about. Hungarian Hasidic Jewry before the war. And the story begins, I guess, with regards to Munkach happening in Munkach. There was a previous Munkach Rebbe, but it really sort of begins for our purposes with someone named Tzvi Hirsch Shapiro. The Shapiro family was the Munkach dynasty. He was the author of the Darkei Tshuva. So the Darkei Tshuva is an important sefer, still used today in yeshivas all over the world. The Darkei Tshuva is a sefer on Yerideya. It is sort of an encyclopedic work on the section of Yerideya, laws of kashrus, things like that. So anybody in Smicha certainly uses the Darkei Tshuva. In a way, it's beginning to be phased out, just because there's so much else that has been written that collects all the previous things. But he did, before the age of computers, collect all the shitos that there were, all the things that there were to say on those chapters. That's known as the Darkei Tshuva. His son was Rav Chaim Elazar Shapiro. Rav Chaim Elazar Shapiro, perhaps, is the when people talk about the Munkach Rebbe, that's who they're referring to. He was known sort of by the moniker, by his sefer that he wrote, called the Minchas Elazar, or the Minchas Elazar, as it's known. He was known as not just a Hasidic Rebbe, but it was one of the Gedolim in pre-war Europe, one of the, and not just in Hasidus, but in terms of learning as well. That's actually one of the quotes later on. But he was known as being, people didn't move without him, and he certainly had extreme power within the city of Munkach itself. Now, not total power, as I discovered a little bit this afternoon, because he, actually, a YouTube video of people dancing, of boys and girls dancing together, the Hora, in downtown Munkach. At least that's what it says. So apparently he didn't have complete power over everything that went on in town, but he certainly was one of the very powerful forces in pre-war Europe. So he was already... He was the oldest son of his father, Tzvi Shapiro, clearly a Eloi, clearly somebody who knew it's learned Torah backwards and forwards, printed a sefer that, or a volume, you know, a voluminous work that clearly demonstrated that. And obviously he was going to be the next Rebbe. And he was, that when his father passed away, I believe in 1913, I wrote it down here someplace, so he right away became the next Rebbe. He was already in his 40s, and that was really a seamless transition from him to his son. Now there was...
This is Rabinowitz.
This is Shapiro. We're not up
Shapiro,
to Rabinowitz yet.
Not to Rabinowitz.
Now how'd the last name change, right? That's already something to think about.
That's why I asked.
So Rav Chaim Elazar Shapiro did not have any children. He got married at the age of 14, you know, one of these 14-year-olds to somebody else, and he did not have any children. And in already near 1905, now that's before he became the Rebbe, but in 1905 he had been married to his wife for 20 years, and they're like, what's going to be? He needs to have a descendant, so he actually got divorced. And the family tradition is that they both cried the entire time, and he still continued to be in touch with her. She predeceased him, and he cried at that time, etc. But he did divorce her, and he got remarried, but there were still... there were still no children until 8 years into his marriage. She got pregnant, and there was a baby girl. Right now, baby girls, that's not so great. That's great, but not quite so great, because internally in the Hasidic world, this is something that gets passed on to ben achar ben, from father to son. So. This girl starts growing up. There is an interesting story. By the way, I just... The main story, what alerted me to the story at all, there's this book, Who Will Lead Us, by Dr. Samuel Hallman. I found it to be a very respectful book. He goes through 5 Hasidic dynasties. Munkach, to me, at least, maybe it's just because it's my family, but it's clearly the most fascinating of these stories. He also talks about the Bianer Hasidim, as well as the Babu Satmar and Lubavitch, who will lead us, because it's about the transition of leadership, which is a sociological perspective of how do you transfer the power, and the charisma is the term that he constantly uses. How do you transfer the charisma from the father to the son? So in the case of the Darchi Tshuva to the Menchas Elazar, that was no problem. So, but Menchas Elazar doesn't have any children. Now, there's a little bit of a theme there, right? There's Hasidic sects that we mentioned, there's another person who didn't have any children, that's the Lubavitch Rebbe, right? The Lubavitch Rebbe didn't have children. I believe the Satmar Rebbe also didn't have children, right? So that was, that's obviously an issue. So he had this girl. He doted on this girl, loved this girl. In this book, he records a story that there's a family tradition that the Hasidim for the Seder night, so all the Hasidim would come and the woman would be in a different room, but the girl would come out to say Manishtana. So she was 3 years old, 4 years old, everybody thought it was cute, and then it's like she's 7 years old, 8 years old. We're like, you know, Rebbe, we're a little uncomfortable with this. He said, listen, she's going to come out and say Manishtana in front of me. If you want, you don't have to be here. That's pretty much what he said. She's going to do that, so you have to make your decision as to what's going to be. But she had to then have a shidduch, and it was clear whoever is going to be the boy that's going to marry her is going to be the next Rav of the next Munkacha Rebbe. Right? That's everybody recognized that's what's going on here. So they found the boy, and that's the title of tonight's year, Rav Baruch Yehoshua Yerachmiel Rabinowitz. He was from Poland. He had Rebbes in his family. He was actually somewhat of a cousin to her as well, and he happened to hail from the town of Siedlec, which probably doesn't mean anything to you, but that happens to be the town that my grandmother came from. So that was took me by surprise. When I went to Poland, when I was in my year in Israel, so we went to Poland. My father came with us on the trip, and we actually drove by her. We got directions. We actually drove by her house, which still stands, my grandmother's house in Siedlec. Yeah, in Poland. That's in Poland. This is all taking place in Hungary, but this boy, Baruchel, came from Poland.
My cousin.
Right, now your cousin, right, I forgot. Sam Samuel's 9th cousin, as we discovered today. So he shows up, so he comes from Poland. He is clearly, you know, he's being trained, etc., in looking to become the Rebbe, but he, you know, is... But this engagement period took a couple of years. During that time, his father-in-law took him under his wing. During that time, also, Baruch's father passed away. 2-3 months later is when the Minchas Elazar made what's a famous trip to Eretz Yisrael. There's a trip that he made to Eretz Yisrael that's known for a couple of interesting things that happened. He went to meet a certain Mekubal. He thought Mashiach was going to come at that point. There's all sorts of theories and possibilities as to what he was thinking by making this trip to Eretz Yisrael. One thing that is known is that he only kept one day of Yontif. That came down from that trip, right? But he went to Europe, came back.
Who's this? This is
father. This was him with future son-in-law with father-in-law. Minchas Elazar took his son-in-law to Israel, which leads to one of the issues. One of the issues is that Baruchel's mother is not so thrilled about this. She feels that my son's been taken away from me. I'm a Rebbetzin in my own right. She had other children also that sort of were taken to various places. And she also, there is a culture conflict between Hungary and Poland. Poland Hasidus was known for being somewhat more open. She was somewhat more worldly. She knew various languages. And the thought of her son now being totally consumed within the world of Munkach made her nervous, and she made sure to get him some, you know, taught him along the way. I don't think she got any secular studies, but his mother certainly influenced some of those things with regards to him. So that's one of the. That was one of the issues. In 1933, they got engaged in 1926. In 1933 is when they got married. Got engaged in 1926. He was 12. I think when they got married, he was 19. So it was a 6-year engagement, or maybe that doesn't quite work out, but something like that. I think he was 19 when he got married. And they're actually, they brought, I saw it, between 20 and 30,000 people came to Munkach for this wedding. It was known as one of the big weddings, and actually video people from America came to videotape this wedding. So there is, you could catch on YouTube here, footage from that wedding. You see it opens up with a bunch of people riding on bicycles. I'm not sure who they were. They're riding on bicycles. There was this 1933.
And video.
There was protection. I'm not sure which part. Yeah, there you could see in the video. There's hired security to make sure to hold everyone back, and then he offered what became a famous speech. They got his attention. The videographer said, "Do you want to give a message to the Jews in America?" So that's, I think, where we're at in this video here. This is the hordes of people. That's the carriage that's carrying the Minchas Elazar with his son-in-law, or about to be son-in-law. There it is. And then it continues on. They actually have footage of the chuppah itself of him saying the brachos. That's the father of the bride. That's the Minchas Elazar talking. So in case you didn't understand what he was saying, so in the Art Scroll book, Great Jewish Speeches, so it actually counts that as one of the speeches. It's the shortest one in the book. It's right here. So what did he say? Kosa Medrash that asserts that Shabbos is unique, nothing compares to it. So I urge you, my brothers in America, observe the Shabbos. Then things will go well for you. It is not enough to go to shul on Shabbos. Don't be machal Shabbos afterwards by driving and working. You must observe the Shabbos. I believe he added on a line at the end that's not included here, which was, and if you don't, bad things are going to happen to American Jewry. So I think that is added in as well. So that is his, as you can see immediately, his personality. I saw today, while looking around, that on one of the Chabad websites, it actually has footage of the Rebbe giving dollars to people. And somebody, two people come and say they knew the Minchas Elazar. And Elazar says, "Oh, he was a great goon." But to one of them, he said, the guy said, did you know the Minchas? Like, you knew the Minchas Elazar, right? He's saying, he said, "I learned by the Minchas Elazar. You knew him," to the Babaji Rebbe. To which the Babaji Rebbe says, "Yeah, I knew him." He says, "You should merit to build many things like the Minchas Elazar." And if you do it in ways of shalom, you'll build even more than the Minchas Elazar. So there clearly was a personality thing. The Minchas Elazar was a tough guy, both in terms of secularism and Zionism and all those things, which all plays into the issues that go with his new son-in-law, Rav Rabinowitz. So he's 19 years old. He's now the son-in-law of the Rebbe. The Rebbe is still alive, but he soon becomes sick. The Minchas Elazar becomes ill. He got cancer, and he passed away only a few years later. I think in 1937 is when he passed away. So lo and behold, you have this Rav Rabinowitz at the age of 22 is being appointed as Rebbe of Munkach, attempting to have to fulfill, to take over for his illustrious father-in-law. So that is a big clash. And while even at the funeral, they did the right things. I mean, there are all these signs of passing things on, which is what Dr. Heilman talks about. As people gave him a kvittel already at the funeral, and he took it, and someone made a pronouncement, like that Shabbos he spoke in shul, and they made a pronouncement. Someone made a pronouncement about it, like, Baruch Hashem, we have continuation, and he was recognized as the Rebbe, meaning they put him, they put a parking spot up with his name on it. But they, it's not so simple to just say, okay, now I'm in charge, especially if he perhaps had a few different ideas of how to run things than his father-in-law had. So he actually left for a little bit, before he became Rebbe, he left for a little bit to go and study in other places, to meet with his mother. He went to Warsaw a little bit, he made some connections, and he also went to Budapest. Now, Budapest is the closest large city to Munkach, as well as to Chust, and he started to begin to see himself, and this was starting to become a theme at the time, of these rebbes who were in small towns moving to larger cities. And he foresaw that for himself. He foresaw that, I want to move the Hasidus from Munkach to Budapest eventually. And he made some trips there to say, trying to find more Hasidim. I mean, we sort of think about it as, oh, well, if you live in these places, you're under this person's domain. Doesn't work like that. Rebbes had to build their constituencies, and they had to have charisma to be able to attract people. And he saw himself perhaps as being that he's going to be able to be bigger than Munkach. Part of it might have been because he thought he maybe was a little broader, and also just he had aspirations of becoming bigger. All signs point to that he was a big Talmud Chacham. He actually wrote his own memoirs, which is where some of this information comes. It's available on Otzer HaChachma. And in fact, the new edition that's on Otzer HaChachma includes about 150 pages beforehand about the history of the Jews of Munkach, etc., etc. So he did some things with regards to his thing. He strengthened the yeshiva a little bit. He did a couple of things during that time. And then the Holocaust happens. And keep in mind also, he is not just remember the Nazis invaded Poland way before they invaded Hungary. There was a period where Poland Jewry was being decimated and Hungary was seen as sort of a safe place to be, but he was a Polish citizen. And at a time of war, they actually came for him and put him on a train to go to Poland. And he went on this train. There is a story that I found on the right 10 minutes before coming here. I just found also a story on YouTube, you can find it, about a person recording that he was had a relationship with the Rebbe. He heard he was on the train, so he packed something. Remember, they went with their stuff, and then they were separated later. So he took his he gave him some kind of package that he embedded, this guy embedded $1,000 in like the seams of this package. And he went to the train where they were loading it up, and it was Shabbos, and he called into each train, where's the Rebbe, where's the Rebbe? And everyone responded like, just, we need water, we need water. And in the last car, he got his attention and he gave him the box, and the Rebbe, and he said, this train, who knows where this train is going, these people could all be dying al Kiddush Hashem. And he said, it's not Kiddush Hashem, because we don't have a choice. Everyone would be Kiddushim. Anybody who dies in the Holocaust will be considered a Kiddush. But it's not technically Kiddush Hashem if you don't decide to do it. He said, but what would be a Kiddush Hashem is to make sure that you maintain Shabbos, and you make sure that you never be Michal Shabbos. That's what the Rebbe said back to this guy, who you can see his film on YouTube. You can check it out afterwards. A 3-minute video where he records this story. At a stop, the Rebbe and his son, he had his oldest son with him as well. Not his wife. The wife and the other. I think there were two other kids at that point. Were hidden by the Rebbetzin, the Minchas Elazar's Rebbetzin, his mother-in-law, which is also one of the issues going on here. He didn't have a great relationship with his mother-in-law. Hid the rest of the kids, but he and his oldest son were taken. At this stop, he was able to separate from the group and hide in a city.
This was like by the Germans?
This is,
by the Polish
government? Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't think it was by the Nazis. Yeah, I think
what year?
What? I think 42. I wrote it down here. It's 41. Part with his son escaped, right? And eventually, he found that he hid in this town. And then he hid in this town. The rest of the train was taken, and he found the entire train was killed. They were all taken to a ditch and were killed on the spot. So he was. But also sort of increases
the train.
He was able to, at a stop, yeah, he was able to get off the train and go and hide. Took his son and go hide. Yeah, I don't know the details how it worked. He was able to go hide and was able to be, and was protected in this town for 2 months. Somehow he was able to get word back to Hungary that he was still alive, and the mother-in-law was able to get papers for him and his son to be able to get back into Hungary. He hid in Budapest for a little bit. And then was able to come out of hiding in Budapest. He was able to get sort of permission from the Hungarian government that he's allowed to be there. And he started trying to get people to move to Hungary, to try to get people across the border from Poland into Hungary. He was involved in those efforts. He also encouraged the people of Munkacs to get out of Munkacs.
Where was his mother?
Yeah, his mother was still in Munkacs.
His mother was in...
Oh, his mother. Oh, his mother in Poland. Yeah, his mother in Poland. I'm not sure when to look back, but they were all, actually, his whole family was killed. Everyone else. His mother, his siblings, they were all killed in the Holocaust. He was able to... at one point... So he sort of became like the Rebbe again in Budapest for these couple of months, I think, while he was there. Maybe it was a year or two while he was there. Ultimately concluding that they're coming for us next. And said, we got to go to Eretz Yisrael and try getting people to go. And pretty much nobody left, including his mother-in-law. His mother-in-law stayed behind with the words saying, I want to be buried in, whatever happens, I want to be buried in Munkacs. He left in March of 1944. In May of 1944, the Nazis invaded, well, Nazis invaded before that, but the Nazis came to Munkacs. Put all the Jews in the ghetto. By May of 1944, Munkacs was Judenrein. It was empty. 30,000 Jews were taken to Auschwitz. And including his mother. His mother was not buried in Auschwitz. His mother was burnt in a crematorium in Auschwitz.
Mother-in-law,
right. So now it's him, his wife, and four kids. A fifth kid was born in Turkey on the way to Eretz Yisrael, but his wife happened to have tuberculosis and was very ill. That was part of the reasons why his mother-in-law would have come, but she didn't. He now ends up in Eretz Yisrael, and he's got nothing. His Hasidim are all stayed behind. He had been there, remember, with his father-in-law, 10 years earlier at this point. There was actually a Munkacs Kollel there, like a Kollel Al Shem Munkacs, which he went to, and they were pretty much like, you know, we don't have anything to do with you, and you know, whatever. But he was also involved in Hatzalah efforts. He started getting involved in trying to figure out how to get Jews in and how to, already the war is coming to a close, but how to get out of the British, the white papers and things like that. And he actually, he started working with the Zionist government at the time. Now, for a Munkacs Rebbe to be working with the Zionist government, that's a huge change. He thinks, you know, I'm not sure what the successes were. He appeared on stage at one point with Ben Gurion and Golda Meir at some rally to fight against the British to get them to undermine the white paper. But he didn't have a parnassah. He didn't have anything. And his wife actually died a year to the day after they arrived in Eretz Yisrael. His wife died. He's got his five kids. Eretz Yisrael, he now doesn't have much money or anything. He actually made an attempt to become chief rabbi of Tel Aviv in, I think, 44 or 45. I think the Rav Salvechik attempt was in 34 or 35. I think this was in 44. He attempted to become chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. pretty much the Belzer Hasidim and the Ger Hasidim were the real powerful Hasidim Eretz Yisrael. Said, no way are we getting. Do you know what his father-in-law said about our parents in Europe? Right? We're not. No way. The Zionists were like, no way could the Munkach Rebbe ever become part of the Zionist entity. So he withdrew his name. Didn't have a chance at that. There were a couple of attempts. He went to America, I think, once or twice to sort of try to rebuild Munkach Hasidim with the survivors that end up in America. A lot of them were like, who are you? You appeared with Ben-Gurion. There's actually a picture in this book. This must have been a few years later. But there's a picture in this book of him with... The picture in this book of him, this must have been a few years later, as you can tell by his white beard, with Ben-Gurion and Rav Goren. Right? I'm not sure who the other one is, the other person is, but he got himself involved in that world, in which case the Hasidim were like, you can take a look if you want. So now he was a person, a big Talmud Chacham, doesn't have a wife, has five children, still all 10 and under, or only 11 and under. The oldest one clearly has post-traumatic stress syndrome. That's what it's, you know, the way that it's described. He asked his sister to move in. His sister moved in for a little bit, but then she had a man that she had met at one point who got in touch with her, and she went to go get married to this man.
She was in Israel?
And left Israel. And he brought in a housekeeper. He had already looked for a nanny. Somebody had interviewed who was like this 19-year-old German Jew, which he was like, which he didn't hire. But then after his sister left, he just called her back and said, you know, come. But now he's got this 19-year-old German living with him. He's 40 at the time or so with these young children. Actually, not even 40, he's 35. So he talked to one of the big people in Munkach, who said, you know, it can't work unless you marry her. So he actually married her in Eretz Yisrael. As opposed to 30,000 people at his first wedding, there were a minion at the second wedding. He was married by the rabbi of whatever town they were in at that point. He wore his strimal to the wedding. But other than that, there's also pictures in the book of his kids with shorts. And pretty much they kept their payas, but other than that, they now were molding into the Israeli society. But then he got a job. In Brazil. He actually became the chief rabbi of São Paulo. Is that how you pronounce it? São Paulo?
São
Paulo in Brazil. He became the chief, which, how many Jews were really there? But he went, and he actually, his stationery said, Rav Rabinowitz, the chief rabbi of Munkach and São Paulo, Brazil. That was his thing.
But
he's
like post-war?
This post-war is in 50, 51, 52.
Refugees there, weren't there?
Right, so there were some refugees. There were Jews. He did a lot of brisses and stuff, but people weren't religious. He was there. And he had now started having other interests. Of course, he learned to drive. He got a dog, which to me is that's wild. Got a dog. He got himself an encyclopedia. He actually started learning some secular studies and got a job teaching in the local university. He taught a philosophy course, and that was life for a little bit. His wife, this German wife, who never didn't want to be a Rebbetzin, she would go to the movies. She had her friends there, and that's how life went for a little bit. A couple of years later, a couple of years into that, he got it. Their oldest son, by the way, he had in New York, was in Tor Vidas. He sort of put him there. And he was taken care of, but he had a sister also in New York at that point. But that was, I should say, not all of his brothers and sisters died. Some of them died in the war. There were, I think, two sisters that survived that are described in the course of the story. So while he was there, there were people who came to Brazil to raise money for their yeshivas. Amongst them was Rav Eliezer Sorotzkin. Rav Eliezer Sorotzkin was raising money and looking for talmidim for the yeshiva of Tells in Cleveland. And he meets these kids. He stays in the house. He meets these kids, and he's like, "This is not gonna." He's like, "How could it be that the grandchildren of the Minchas Olazar can't read a daf of Gemara. How could it be? And he convinced that he knew the father was kind of didn't want to be with the Hasidus, so he said, "You're not going. Let me take them to Telz in Cleveland, and they'll learn how to learn Gemara. They'll learn in a Litvish yeshiva." Father agreed. He sent the second oldest one is Chaim Elazar, the third oldest is Moshe Leib. A year later, he sent the fourth boy Yitzhak Yosef, and he sent them to Telz in Cleveland. In that book, he records that the Rav Mutzel Katz, who was the Rosh Yeshiva in Telz, when they showed up, pulled them aside and tells them, do you know who your grandfather was, your great-grandfather was? Nobody moved in Europe without, made a halachic decision in Europe without consulting your grandfather, without consulting your great-grandfather. And then he adds in at the end here, he says, I understand there's a possibility that Hasidim might show up one day and want you to become their Rebbe. He says, if you don't sing songs or hand out shirayim, you can learn, they'll let it pass, you'll figure that out. But if you can't learn Torah like the Talmud Chacham, then you can never be a Makasha Rebbe. And the kids started learning. One of them had a chavrusa with Rav Gifter, a young Rav Gifter at the time. And they started learning, and lo and behold, a couple of years, a year or two later, two Munkasher Hasidim. There's Gabai, and there was this Williger, who the fellow named, who the father was still in touch with, show up in Cleveland and say, we hear there's some, we want to talk to these boys about possibly becoming the next day. They met them. They didn't officially make the offer, but they told them what the story was and left. A year later, they show up again, make the offer. They ask the older son first. The oldest is not there. But they ask Chaim Elazar, and Chaim Elazar says, not a chance. I'm not becoming Rebbe. I know what you did to my father. I don't want to have that public life. I'm not going to be for me. And then they went to the younger son, Moshe Leib. Moshe Leib said, I'm not going to say no. He went that year, that Pesach, he went to his aunt, who was living in Brooklyn, and then showed himself up in the last days, ended up by this Gabbai in Brooklyn, which was where the Munkasher Hasidim were, and that began his training to become there. He went back and tells, he went back and forth, and he started learning the stuff. He had to start growing a beard, he had to start growing his payas, he had to do all of the things that he... but he started getting involved in that world again, and after doing this for a couple going back and forth, he found himself in Brooklyn, and they said, okay, we need to find a wife for him, and they found somebody from the Sopran world was going to marry him, and it was understood that after that wedding was over, so then he was going to become the Munkasher Rebbe. This was Moshe Leib. So he did. They found somebody, and then he flew down to Brazil to talk to his father about it. Right now, this is not a simple thing. This move that they're doing, they're pretty much retiring the father and taking on the son. Right? That doesn't happen. And he went to the father, and the father obviously understood what was going on here, and said, you can't be reliant on them. Right? Look what happened to me. You can't be reliant on them. I think you should go to college first, and then become the rebbe. And he said, like you don't get it. He said, it can't work that way. Like it needs to be a relationship of, yeah, they might be reliant on me, but I have to be reliant on them. That's the only way. I can't be there sort of halfway in with an out if potentially this doesn't work out. And he did not get his father's bracha. His father did not think that it was a good idea. He came back, said, we're going to go ahead and do this. And decided on the wedding date. And it was decided also the Sakhmer Rav, Viola's son, I forget now. I'm not sure if, in terms of the years which one it was. I think it was Rav Yoel, that he was going to be the Masada Kedushin and not his father. That's why he actually got married on Motzi Shabbos that way, as far as beyond, so the Sakhmer Rebbe would come wearing his strimal, and very late at night. That's the way these weddings took place, very late at night. And the father did come, but he was sort of on the side as being, not being the Masada Kedushin. He got married. There is the dancing starts taking place. First, he dances with his father. He danced with the other rebbes that were present. Apparently, there's been hugging that you can't dance longer than the father. I mean, the father dances the longest, and the others do, and they dance. There's all protocols to this.
This is Munkah.
The Sakhar Rav was the Masada Kedushin, but his father was there. His father came from Brazil for the wedding. Yes. Did I write down the year? I believe it was Sakhar Rav himself. Right. Yeah, that makes sense. He came in, and then this Gabbai who had really raised him and really had trained him and got him ready and found the shidduch and paid for the wedding and raised all the money for everything that's going on right now, took him and started dancing with him more than any of the other Rebbes did and longer than the father did. And the father couldn't take it anymore and jumped, and there was a little bit of a brawl, pulled out some hair, etc., and they had to be separated. And then the father stopped the music, took the microphone, this is all described in the book here, and pretty much let him have it and said, you know, I'm very hurt, and said his thing. But the Hasidim weren't, it wasn't like he claimed his Hasidus back. The Hasidim were like, okay, like we're here, like, but we're moving on. And they pretty much ushered him out. He left, didn't stay for Sheva Brachos. His brother, actually, this Chaim Elazar, I have to mention, this is fascinating. Chaim Elazar, the brother who rejected the Hasidus, left Telz after that and went to Eretz Yisrael to learn Merkaz Harav. He got married a week later, and the father was at that wedding a week later. Went back to Brazil, but already started planting the seeds in order to stay in Eretz Yisrael. Got a job as the chief rabbi of
the brother,
the father. The father went back to Eretz Yisrael. Got a job as the rabbi of Hadera, and then of wanted Hadera, didn't get Hadera. Became the rabbi of Chalon, and then became the rabbi of Petach Tikva. Ultimately, being buried in Petach Tikva. And this young Moshe Leib, now I think about it, this seems like ancient history. He's not so old. He's actually still the current rabbi. Now sitting in Brooklyn, he's in his 70s. And he's running the show in Munkach. Munkach has grown. If you walk around Borough Park, Bava is the biggest chassidus in Borough Park, but Munkach is a close second from what I can tell. They have a big place on 13th Avenue, and if you walk around, you'll see other signs of Munkach, the yeshiva, and the girls' school, and the camp, and all these things, all built in various places around Baruch Park. So this Rav Baruch sort of continued this like dream of sort of being a Rebbe of the Rebbes, of being this sort of above Hasidus type thing, and it just never materialized. So, yeah, you see the after effects of the war, how things totally changed, how communities were totally upended, but how they were also were rebuilt over the course of the last couple of decades. So, that's the story.
Okay.
There's obviously some other details. If anyone would like to borrow the book here, you're welcome to lend it out. I don't know. It doesn't say what happened to the oldest son.
The one with the Merkaz HaRav?
No, that's the second oldest. The oldest son had PTSD and lived that way the rest of his life, it sounds like. Right, the second oldest son ended up in Merkaz HaRav. Not sure what happened to him. The third oldest son is him, who is still the current Munkach Rebbe. And the fourth, he had a brother, actually, who he talks about became one, sort of claimed that for himself, he put up a shingle in Flatbush, calling himself the next. There's the next brother, Yaakov Yosef, who named himself the Munkach Rebbe of Flatbush. And then the Munkach Rebbe of Williamsburg, but there were negotiations and pretty much he just backed down and to the benefit of everybody. So now there's the one Munkach Rebbe, who of course at the end that nobody knows who the he's got children, he's got grandchildren. There's actually a video on YouTube of him going to Munkach in about 5-6 years ago with like 300 Hasidim. They went and spent Shabbos there and davening by his grandfather's kever, where he had never been. It's in honor of his grandson's bar mitzvah. So he's got plenty of children and etc. He recorded.
So about the
I don't know anything. I'm just a guy in Philadelphia. But he he records at the end that nobody knows what, you know, in theory they write wills, they should write wills and sort of declare who the next person is going to be. When that doesn't happen, so then you get issues like Babov and Satmar, which are also discussed over the course of that book.
So the current Rebbe is the son of the one that the class is named after?
Baruch Ravino, it's the son, is the current Munkacha Rebbe. Right.
So the grandson of the one that died in Europe.
Yes.